This is it was supposed to be the last classes on the Nitziv, but I believe we're going to go not just today as well as next class as well. I don't really need to upload anything at the moment. I could show you the book. A number of people have asked me. You know what? Let me turn off that light there. Oh, it's not in your eyes. Oh, Paul's saying much better in and out. Okay. I'll do my best. If it's not on my, if only some people are getting it in and out. Usually the sound is very good. A number of people have asked me. I refer to this book by Tikashinsky on the yeshiva on the Chevron Yeshiva, Slabodka Yeshiva. Here is the book. You can see it. I don't need to. Lamdanut Musar of Elitism, Lamdanus Musar and Elitism, Yeshiva Slabodka from Lita to Israel. And it's about the Chevron Yeshiva. I think this picture is amazing because that gives you a sense of who these people were, dressed very modern. And this book, it isn't just about the Chevron Yeshiva, it's about the Slabodka Yeshiva and the philosophy. Okay, it's a problem in and out, I'm saying. Is that for everyone? Okay, Mel says not for him. If it's fine, if everyone else is hearing fine, then it's a problem on your end that we can't fix it, unfortunately. Okay. But you'll get the tape. The tape will be clear if you don't want to if you can't stay online. Very good. Okay, so let's pick up where we were. Those who haven't been with us, this is a Rabbi Kelman asked me just to mention. I think this is the 193rd class. I think we're doing on Torah in Motion Gedolim, and we're pretty much finishing up the Nitziv this week and next week. But if you find it of interest, you can download from the website. Israel, how can you get the books? Well, you can get the books from well, now. I don't know if Israel is shipping any books. Abigail Eisen, who unfortunately just passed away, one of the owners of the store, he was selling them. The Tikashinsky and Iyakas book both come. That's from Shazar, Merkaz Shazar. The Iyakas book, I think, is also Shazar or maybe Magnus. In America, the best thing to do is to order them. From Israel when they start shipping again. Okay, let's pick up right where we left off. The big question, after everything we've seen, why did the Volozhin Yeshiva close? Why was it closed, I should say? And the famous story, and we'll get back to this later today when we see Rav Chaim Berlin's letter, is because of the order of the Russian government. They had to, they ordered them to have secular studies. And of course, the yeshiva could comply with secular studies, and therefore the yeshiva had to close. Now, this is the tradition. As I said, this is the view as stated by Rav Chaim Berlin, who was there, who lived through it. Although we'll see that he doesn't, Rav Chaim Berlin doesn't actually contradict what we now know from the history books, but he's usually cited as saying what I told you. But the problem is obvious. Why was the yeshiva allowed to exist for so long? Why, after the yeshiva closed, was it then allowed to open up not that much, many years afterwards? What about all the other yeshivas? There's plenty of other yeshivas. How come the government never forced them to shut down or forced them to have secular studies, the same extensive order? Only with the fall of the Soviet Union and the opening of the Tsarist archives do we really know what was going on. And, book that we've mentioned almost every single class, Shaul Stompfer's book, Lithuanian Yeshivas in the 19th Century. He published his a first volume in Hebrew, the first edition in Hebrew, and then he published a second edition, which took into account the information we're going to see now. So the first edition, I think, was 95. The second edition maybe is 2005. And this, the English edition, this is even better. It's not just it's a translation. Yeah, the first edition is 95. Then in 2005, this is 2012. So it isn't just a translation, it also takes into account more updated scholarship. Okay, so What is it first about secular studies? Yes, there was a demand from the Russian government to institute secular studies. There was even a ruling given saying as much as far back as 1844. However, these rulings were always ignored by the yeshiva, and the government apparently had no interest in enforcing this rule. In 1890, for the first time, the Nitziv established classes in Russian and mathematics under the authority of the yeshiva, apparently fearing that the yeshiva would be shut down if they did not institute these classes. You can read all about it in J.J. Schachter's article. It's really a classic article, I think. It's in the Torah Mada Journal 2 from 1990. The article is called Haskalah, Secular Studies, and the Close of the Yeshiva in Volozhin in 1892. It's not just about the close of the yeshiva. It's all about what the Volozhin yeshiva was like in terms of Haskalah and the different issues that were going on there. The article was what precipitated it was the Lakewood Cheder had sent out an example. I sent out the copy of the book, My Uncle the Nitziv, which is an English translation of selections dealing with the Nitziv from the Torah Tanimah's book, Makor Baruch. And people obviously protested it and they asked for the book. They wanted to get it back. It was a mistake sending the book out. The book does not meet the standards of the Nitziv, his Hashkafos, Kedusha, and Yirat Shamayim, as related to us by his revered Talmidim, the ones who knew him best. This comes from the letter from the Lakewood Cheder School. They're upset. They'll reimburse you for any donation you may have sent to get the book. And as an example of the true Nitziv, his son, HaGaon Rav Chaim Berlin, quotes his father regarding the decision to close the doors of the famed Volozhin Yeshiva rather than instituting secular studies into the program. So that was clearly one of the problems that they had, that there was a description of secular studies. And that precipitates the article, which is a very extensive article, very well done by Jacob J. Schachter. And that article was written before 1990, before we have the information we have now. But we know that the Nitziv did institute secular studies. We know, first of all, he didn't reject secular studies. If you recall last week, I read from you the responsum, the letter of his to his grandfather that it appears in my recent book. But also the same idea is found in a number of other places, as I told you, that the Nitziv had no problem with secular studies. He saw secular studies as valuable, as way not independently, but enable you to understand passages of Torah better. However, you Torah lachud, secular studies lachud, that secular studies should be studied at a separate time, either before, he says, or after, but not at the same time. The yeshiva has to be completely holy, completely devoted for Torah studies. However, because of the pressure of the Russian government, he itself, not per se in the yeshiva building, a separate building right next door, but owned by the yeshiva. We also know that he hired teachers, tutors for his sons, Yaakov and Meir, to teach them Russian. These were his children from his second wife. We do not know with his eldest son, Reb Chaim, who I already gave the years. I think what he's 47 years, I think I said, older than Meir Bar Ilan. We don't know if he was hired in Russian, but we know the other children were. Okay, so get back to the story. We're still stuck with the problem, though. We're going to see the how much the Russian government demands so much secular studies, it will be the end of the yeshiva. Why? And why not within the other yeshivas? Well, before we get to the answer to this, let's do a little more of the history. When it was time for the Nitziv to choose his successor, he chooses his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, rather than his grandson-in-law, that is his daughter's son, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was also teaching at the yeshiva. And this then leads to the great dispute that we spoke about in class number one and or class number two. And it split the yeshiva. It split it for a few reasons. And many of the students, I'll read you some selections. I'm not going to read you what I read you already, but I'll read you some other ones, really opposed this. They saw this as nepotism. They did not see Rav Chaim Berlin as anywhere near the level equal of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. In terms of Torah scholar, you might say that he was his equal in terms of knowledge, but the young people were very much attracted also to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's new approach, new method, Lummus. Rav Chaim Berlin was, as the old joke said about the Beis HaLevi said regarding his son, that he was born before Matan Torah. Rav Chaim Berlin was before Matan Torah. That is, his shiurim, the sort of shiurim he would give, did not measure up intellectually in of what they were getting from Rav Chaim Brisker. Not to mention the fact that really Rav Chaim Brisker, being a Lamdin and being a great Torah scholar is not measured by how much you know. It measures by the profundity. And no one's going to say that Rav Chaim Berlin was the equal of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik in terms of profundity, even leaving aside the new Brisker derech. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was a very unique person. Now, if you look in Stamfer's book on page 216, you can just see some of the reactions. So, as I said, I'm not going to repeat everything I told you already. I mean, Meir Bar-Ilan, when he portrays it differently. He says that the students, he says, my brother was no less distinguished in learning than anyone else, but he was more modern. He wanted to set regular hours for meeting with the students, which was an innovation. He had been a rabbi in Moscow, and he wanted to do new approaches, but that doesn't seem to be the reason. The reason seems to be what I told you before. So, for example, let me read you from page 221 in Stamfer's book. This is one of the memoirs by a man named Zlatkin. The best students and married students opposed this appointment and tried to cancel it by all available means. Whenever Rav Chaim Berlin began to deliver a shiur, the most sharp-witted students would surround him and pose difficult questions he was unable to answer, and they would embarrass him in this way. And he harassed him in other ways. He goes on to say how they wrote to the Netziv, expressing their opposition to this appointment. They also wrote to famous rabbis and great scholars, asking them to intervene to prevent the yeshiva from falling into the hands of one who didn't deserve the title of Rosh Yeshiva. Not only that, it says that every morning they would cover the main door with posters of Rav Chaim. They put him in this like Melitza d'Kloshon. They would hang on the door there parodies of poems and dirges in which he was ridiculed and mocked. Obviously, this isn't Kavod HaTorah. This isn't, but as we know, the yeshiva students, just like today, the yeshiva students were young guys, late teens, early 20s, and many of them didn't acted in ways that probably they would be embarrassed about in years later. But they wanted to show that he was not deserving of this position, and it was a full-fledged revolt. Incidentally, before I go on, Bill Gewirtz showed me that Daniel Boyarin, when he speaks of the Netziv in a recent book, he doesn't call him the Netziv, he calls him the Natziv, Natziv, obviously because Naftali, Tzvi, so NA. But that's really, I mean, in the yeshiva world, the tradition is to call him the Netziv. Then it goes on at page 222, quotes another memoir, no, sorry, a Russian government document that three occasions where Chaim Berlin tried to give a shiur and students disrupted it. And once, and this comes from a memoir of Shapiro, Shmuckler, Ramosha Shmuel. It's a very interesting book about the Lithuanian yeshiva world on Ramosha Shmuel Shapiro, I think was his last name. He mentions that once Reb Chaim Berlin is physically prevented from ascending the bima to give his shiur. And it goes on, there are posters attacking him, there are violent incidents in which yeshiva property was destroyed. In the there's a reflection of this in the first draft of Bialik's famous poem, Hamasmit, et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to, except on page 223, you see that Rav Chaim Berlin also had students who supported him. And the windows and the glass in the windows of his apartment were broken. Once he found also a terrible thing written about him there. So you can read all about the machlokes there. We don't need to get into it in detail here. What's important for us is that throughout this dispute, and for those who ask some questions, I'll come to them at the end. For those, so then throughout the dispute, details of this information was coming to the government. They were receiving reports on what was going on, and they were not happy. They obviously had informants, people were telling you about this. We know that there were people voluntarily who fed information to the government, who wrote letters to the newspapers as well, because they were inclined to Haskalah, or they didn't like the way the yeshiva was going. We don't know if that's where the Russian government was getting this information, or they actually solicited this information. And the government was not happy. Of course, the Russian government is not happy whenever things are not smooth, whenever there's revolts. You know, a revolt in the yeshiva or in the university could lead to some sort of wider revolt. They like peace and quiet, and generally they would get peace and quiet because the rabbis always preach, you know, loyalty to the Tsar, no troublemakers, etc. So they weren't very happy, and the decision was made to close the yeshiva. Bamfer is able to let us in on documents, which come a number of documents that were found with the opening of the Russian archives. First of all, what was, before we get to those documents, how did the government, though, shut the yeshiva? They didn't shut the yeshiva by just issuing an order that the yeshiva had to be closed. Rather, they came up with a way of a more elegant way, I guess you could put it, of closing the yeshiva, so they didn't have to directly close it. The order was that as follows, and of course the yeshiva, the government knew that no yeshiva could accept what was ordered, and it would have to close. The hours between 9 and 3 should be general studies. There's no Torah studies between 9 and 3. Of course, you can't have yeshiva if you don't have Torah study between 9 and 3. The total number of hours of study time shall not exceed 10 hours. So between 9 and 3, you're already dealing with 6 hours. Yes, you're already dealing with that. So then, what are you going to do? You only have 4 hours. Nocturnal study will not be permitted at the yeshiva under any circumstances. You can't. The yeshiva has to shut down by like 7 o'clock. So there's no learning at night. That's clearly destroying the yeshiva. And it says both, as Sanford says, both sides understood that demands were excessive and completely unrealistic. There's no way that they could have accepted this. So then why? Why were they led to do this? The answer is clear, as Sanford explains and goes on, that it all had to do with the government wanting to shut down this institution, which they thought was getting out of hand with all sorts of acts of rebellion, stirring up trouble. Here's from, let me just read you from one of the Russian documents. From the facts noted above, the conclusion emerges that the Volozhin Yeshiva is currently disintegrating, and there is no reason to hope that the present yeshiva administration, if it exists at all, is capable of restoring a proper way of life to this institution. There's no administration in the yeshiva, etc., etc. The Berlin and Soloveitchik are completely incapable of performing the educational authorities, are completely incapable of performing. That is, they're not able to do what they need to do so that the educational institution authorities will allow it to be opened, etc., etc. So now, so we can conclude that the real reason for the closing of the Volozhin Yeshiva and the reason why then it was able to be reopened just a few years later under a new Rosh Yeshiva, Rafal Shapiro, the son-in-law of the Nitziv, because they thought he could restore order just a few years later. That shows us that the issue there here was student revolt, lack of chaos in the yeshiva, fighting between the different branches of the yeshiva, and they decided to shut it down until they can be guaranteed, until the authorities could be guaranteed that when it would reopen with under order, with a system. And that's the reason why the yeshiva was closed. One more thing, I'll just show you from Stanford that he mentions. Yes, from another, it's on page 250, from another government document. This is a document titled On the Yeshiva at Volozhin in the Vilna Province. He says, in 1890, the Governor General of Vilna raised the question of the need to close the Volozhin Yeshiva by virtue of its being a hotbed of Jewish fanaticism and serving as a refuge for Jews of doubtful loyalty and an anti-government institution. Yeah, it's not clear how that. It means to say, people who they don't respect the rules of the government, and but you can never have the big issues in the yeshiva would actually come in 1905, when you had revolt in Russia itself, and you had that played out in the yeshivas as well. But the authorities were always concerned about any sort of trouble like that. So that explains that. And I'll come back to any questions later. What I want to move on to now is some of the letters in the Mitziv in 2003, and it's very nice. It puts together, it's in two volumes. It puts together the approbations in the Mitziv. They collected the letters in the Mitziv from all over. The problem is, I have to say, is that they don't tell you where the letters come from. We'll see in one example that for the approbations, it's obvious, but and many of these letters are well known, they should have told us about each letter where it comes from. Today, it's not so hard to find on Utsar Chachma, but it was a mistake. But let me just give you some insight from these letters. I've used some of them already, but some of what they tell you about the Nitziv. So, for example, in volume one, here on, I think it's two volumes. I'm only holding volume one here. I can't remember if there's a volume two that's come out yet or not yet. I think so. Okay, so if you turn to page 70 in volume one, it records here there was a gathering in St. Petersburg in 1887 dealing with education in the yeshivas. And if you read the hagiographies, what you get is that the rabbis were always opposed to secular studies. That they fought tooth and nail, and they can tell you the story how the Chafetz Chaim went to the Polish Minister of the Interior and got him to remove all the requirements of secular studies. You'll be told how the Nitziv closed the yeshiva down rather than agreeing for secular studies. And while there's some truth in this, most of this is not really true. And we know that there are many, many rabbis who did believe in cooperating with the government. The whole issue of the crown rabbis, you had many real rabbani who were also crown rabbis. They had to study secular subjects in the classes on the Meshech Chachma, on Ramir Simcha of Divinsk. We went into some detail about the famous rabbinic conference there dealing with secular studies. But here is the decrees. Well, I'll give you some of them, which the rabbis, and just to know who these rabbis are, this is signed by the Nitziv, Rav Yisrochel Inspector, the Beis HaLevi, and Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz. Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz is the son of Rav Yisrochel Inspector. He has a different name for another reason. The Rav of Lodz, Eliyahu Chaim Meisel, Chaim Yaakov Vidorovitz of Moscow. He's known because he comes to America not long after this. And he becomes the big, he's the Hasid, he's a Hasid, he's a Chabadnik, and he becomes the big antagonist for Rav Yaakov Yosef. Everyone assumes Rav Yaakov Yosef was the chief rabbi of, of New York, of the Lower East Side. Well, he was a chief rabbi, but there was another chief rabbi. He was the Yaakov Yosef was the rabbi for the Lithuanian community. However, there was other Jews. There were Polish Jews. There was Hasidic Jews, and but Vidrovitz is famous because he's the one that the story goes back to, that he put the sign up. He made a sign which he hung up saying, Chief Rabbi of New York, I think it was. And they asked him, who made you chief rabbi? And he said, the sign maker. But he happened to be a real Talmud Chacham. And so he signed this letter. And the final one is Yitzhak Yaakov Reines, who himself would open up a yeshiva which had secular studies in Leiden. We're going to get back to Reines later today. So listen to some of the decrees that they agree to do. I don't think you're going to get this in the art scroll book. Regarding Ketav v'lashon Rusya b'yeshivot, in concerning the study, the writing, and speaking of Russian in yeshivot, they say that even though most of the people, Rov haba'im lo mod b'yeshivot, most of those who come to study in the yeshivot, they already know how to read and write Russian, because they already learned this before coming to the yeshiva. Nevertheless, Mechuyav Harosh Yeshiva Achazik Morek Tav Lashon Medinatenu Rusya. They say that in the yeshivas, and at this time, really, this is 1887, we had the Lashon, you had Mir. The other yeshivas were Mir, Slobodka was just getting started, but it says that they obligated to have someone to teach them those Russian to the students. What this meant really was that those students who didn't know Russian, they would a couple hours a week they'd have a tutor who would come and teach them. So that if the inspector came and spoke to them, you know, they would see that they're doing that. Most of the students, as it says, already knew Russian, so they didn't need to do any of this. They were exempted. But there's a commitment from the yeshivas to do this. Whether they actually did this or not, in some places, I'm sure they ignored it entirely. These rules were often made to be broken as long as the government wasn't insisting on it. But in Volozhin, they were very careful. In Volozhin, they actually did it. And we spoke how in Pressburg. Pressburg is not here. Pressburg, they did it as well also for other reasons. But we know that in Volozhin, they did. But it's not in the yeshiva. That a separate place. You can't have it in the yeshiva. So you have a little house next door where the students who don't know would go when they'll learn Russian. And it says here, the B'nai Yeshiva HaTzrichim, those who need to know Russian will come and they'll learn from the teacher there. Those students who knew Russian, they were able to be, you see in Russian those days, you had two types of rabbis. You had the crown rabbi who's generally was just a functionary to record births and deaths and represent the community before the government. And then you had the spiritual rabbi, who was a Talmud Chacham, who did all the Paskan, all the Shilas. But you had some Talmud Chachamim, if they knew the language well enough, they could read and write Russian, especially the younger generation, they could also be crown rabbis. And that's good for the communities, because the communities, therefore, would only have to pay one salary. Otherwise, you have to pay two salaries. Normally, we don't hear of the crown rabbis because they don't really have any role, except if they're significant. But Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was a crown rabbi. Of the old generation, the old Talmidei Chachamim, we also have some who are crown rabbis. Eliyahu Klatskin. Eliyahu Klatskin is a Gaon Shebegaonim. He was a crown rabbi. He, at the end of his life, he comes to Israel, and even though he's a Litvak, and I was corrected, although he studies with the Litvaks, he has Hasidic background, he joins the Yedah Haredi. His son, Yaakov Klatskin, you might know the name, a leading Zionist figure, who, of course, began as Yeshiva Bacher. We even have Chidushei Torah he wrote. He becomes a complete heretic, ends up marrying a non-Jew, dies in Switzerland, a genius, even in scholarship. He wrote a work which is still used, of medieval philosophical Hebrew words, like a medieval philosophical dictionary, how the Rishonim in their philosophical texts, you know, use these words. In fact, in my last forum blog post, I referred to it regarding the word dibas, slander, how it's used in medieval times. So you need to know Russian. Then it says, however, this is important. Number two, that the teacher who's teaching Russian should only teach Ktav v'lashon, only teach, you know, writing and reading, just the language, but not use any sifrei chofesh hadeyot, not any free-thinking literature or romanin. Romanin are novels. In other words, you're not going to give the students problematic things to read. I guess they could just sit and read the newspaper or things like that. And also, chalil ha'mora. You know, God forbid that the teacher, when he speaks with the students, to discuss ideas which would raise up free thinking or, these novels. Like you can imagine the teachers seeing these students who they think are backwards and unenlightened, starting to learn Russian, and then recommend to them, you should, why don't you go, start reading Dostoevsky or Pushkin? It's bad enough when they're telling them to read Mapu and all the other problematic works, but Yalag, etc. So that then third point, in order to make sure that what happens what happens, we just said in letter two, that no wrote novels or free thinking literature, the Rosh Yeshiva will be the one to pick the teacher. and only the Rosh Yeshiva can pick the teacher, and then it says the teacher will have a diploma from the government. And then it goes on to say that this is not, we can't go any further than this. Limud hayadiyot v'hamada'im, I guess, you know, limud hayadiyot v'hamada'im means like secular studies, not just language, but actually teaching them humanities, I guess you could say. That they say we can't do, that will not improve the yeshiva. Rather, it will yashpilu matzava. It will destroy the yeshiva. Why? Because those people who donate to the yeshiva, anshei chesed hamachzikim b'hem, v'tomchim otam b'kispam, those people who support the yeshiva, they'll stop supporting it. They'll say, you know, well, we want to support a yeshiva. We're not paying to support a yeshiva university sort of thing. And then it says, within short time, the yeshiva will lose its surah, its form. It won't be a yeshiva, and it'll tilbash surah cheret. It'll become another institution, and that'll be, and what'll be the end? Achrit yeshiva chas hashalom achrit harabin reshmul. That at the end, the yeshiva will just end up looking no different than the rabbinical, the in Vilna and in Zhytomyr, there were two rabbinical schools set up by the government, and everyone knew those were not places for real Talmidei Chachamim. These were rabbi factories for the crown rabbis. That'll be the end of the yeshiva. It won't be a yeshiva. It'll be another government rabbinic factory. So therefore, you can't have, we can't institute any other courses, which is what the Maskilim really wanted. This is not directed to the government. This is directed to the Maskilim, who wanted, they thought that the yeshivas were these dark places. And the enlightenment has to come to it. The interesting point about the it's an interesting point about the donors, because that's what happened in America. You can read about how Yeshiva Sirbitzel Chanan, which is what Yeshiva University becomes. First, it's, well, before it's Yeshiva Sirbitzel Chanan, it's Eitz Chaim. It's just a yeshiva, but the students who are there want secular studies. They want basically a high school. They don't want to have to go just to the yeshiva and not and go to public school or and come after public school or not go to public school at all, just go a couple years of public school and then go to yeshiva. They want to combine it all in one place. And they go on strike, as I recall, when they protest. The people who were opposed to it were not the rabbis. The rabbis actually understood in America that you need to give the kids secular education. Otherwise, no one's going to want to do advanced Torah study. How are you going to make a living? They wanted people to speak the language. It was the people who had donated the money, the funders, who were business people, had come over, but they were opposed to this. They said, that's not a yeshiva. And finally, the last thing which they... that's the last thing they say in terms of requirements that they need. And then it goes on talking about how the old way of the yeshiva, that's the best way for the Jewish people, et cetera, et cetera. It says, you know, have mercy on our Torah. Remember our holy fathers, don't mess with the yeshiva, etc., etc. And this is in Hebrew, so it's addressed to the enlightened Jews who had ties with Russia, with the Russian government, and they say, they ended off that we pray that that God will give to you, will find before you, you know, mercy before our Adonenu, the Tsar, that he'll do you know, great things for the Jewish people, etc. On page 100 and the Eilech, and continuing, you have a similar letter. The title of it is "Keneged Hamakatrigim Al Yeshiva Volozhin," against those who are attacking the Volozhin Yeshiva. This is a common theme among the Maskilim attacking, and it's not just the Maskilim. You had letters which they published in the newspapers, Hamelitz and the other similar papers, which would be sent anonymously from yeshiva students in the Volozhin yeshiva, talking about how they don't allow us to read, literature. And so, what are these yeshiva students doing there? Why, if they don't want to learn or they want to do all these other things, as we said already, the yeshiva, Volozhin yeshiva at this time, wasn't just yeshiva students like we think of today. People went to yeshivas for all sorts of reasons. They went to because they couldn't go to the universities, that this was a center of intellectual pursuits. They went because they heard there was maskilim there. They went because they knew they can get a good shidduch. They went to escape from home. You had all sorts of people in the yeshiva, which you might not imagine today you would have. Although even today, more in Israel than in America, but in Israel, certainly you have all sorts of types. I can tell you personally, from personal experience, very similar to the Volozhin yeshiva in Israel, you have all sorts of people. Because for most of these people in Israel, they're going there not because their learning is their focus in life, it's because they have to do that. It's part of the communal expectation. The yeshivas in Israel are full of people who would not be there if they didn't have to go. And the reason they have to go is because they don't want to go into the army either, because they don't personally don't want to, or because societally they can't go. They'd be thrown out of their society. So Israel today is full of people who have all sorts of interesting ideas. Some are intellectuals and they see them on the blogs and other places, and others just don't want to be there. They're shababniking, as they call them. In Volozhin, however, you didn't have the shababniking, the people who just want to have a good time, and who you see if you, well, when coronavirus is gone, Baruch Hashem, you go downtown Jerusalem at 11 p.m. and go into the places where they play the video games and they watch the soccer games. You'll see plenty of yeshiva bachrim there. And I'm not talking about the ones who are into the intellectual stuff, but in the Volozhin yeshiva, you had a lot of them who just really wanted enlightenment. And if they would have done very well if they were in Germany, Torah Derech Eretz. Some of them end up becoming enlightened Orthodox rabbis. Some of them end up going to Germany. Others end up leaving Orthodoxy entirely, and they were taken in by other ideologies. Zionism in particular, but not just Zionism. Now this, so who's this letter addressed to, though, the Nitziv on page 109? To Elijah Harkavi. Harkavi was himself a Maskil, an enlightened Jew, but he was also in St. Petersburg, but he was also a traditional Jew that is traditionally observant. The Nitziv had a very good relationship with him. There were a number of these Maskilim or enlightened Jews who Vilna was full of them, who were friendly with the Nitziv. So when you think of the word maskilim, the way it's used, it means something different in Germany, in Galicia, in Vilna, or in Lithuania as a whole. You had different types of people under this term now, and the Nitziv had very good relationships with Avi, and he writes to him now that that you see from this that Harkavi was also in touch with the Yeshua Heschel Levin, who we spoke about, who was also very much involved in the yeshiva. But he writes to him about how important the Volozhin yeshiva is, and the people who oppose it don't understand. Mahu pilpul shel hevel. They would always say that in the yeshiva in Volozhin are doing all these pilpulim, and then the Tziv says we don't do pilpul here. He says darki yadua b'sifri ha'amekshala. Everyone knows I don't do pilpul. It's the bad type of pilpul. So he's explaining, he says, we follow the path of the Grav, Acharav Hagaon, Reb Chaim Volozhin, and all the pilpul we do is proper way of learning. And basically, he's explaining to Harkavi and that these people who criticize the Volozhin yeshiva, they don't know what learning is. Any learning to them is pilpul shel hevel. And he's calling upon Harkavi to stand with us and. If we, he goes on that if we follow the path of these foolish maskilim, he calls them, there won't be any yeshiva, not one yeshiva left. All we'll have left is a seminary here. And because he goes on, he says, I'm not opposed to secular studies, but we cannot achieve greatness unless you fill your belly with shas and poskim. This has to come first. And that was the big problem. The Maskilim thought that the students in Volozhin, in addition to being in Torah study, they also need to have a complete secular education as well. Well, I'll go on for about another 15 minutes and then I'll get the questions. Another thing I'll call your attention to, page 119. Everyone today, when they do these East European trips, they go to Volozhin and they see the building, the Volozhin Yeshiva building. I have never been to Volozhin. That's one of the places I haven't been to. But you see here, and this is a letter from 1886, a fundraising letter. Why? Because the Volozhin Yeshiva, the entire Yeshiva has been burnt down completely. The Beit HaGadol that they were there for in more than 80 years, the whole thing has been destroyed. So what you see the building today, that's not the original building. That's the one that they rebuilt. And this is a letter from 1886. On page 150, it has the famous letter of Reb Chaim Berlin. The letter, the title that they give it is, here it is. You can see it there. And this is, he says, as a memorial of what my father commanded me before his death, that he was Moser Nefesh on the Volozhin Yeshiva, not to bring into it Shum Limudei Chol, and for this reason the yeshiva closed. And he suffered in his last day, and he says, don't agree to this at all. God has told us in Kodesh V'Chol, that Chol cannot be mixed with Kodesh. Limudei Chol cannot receive Kedusha. On the contrary, Kedusha suffers from Chol. And then it says that this matter caused him, his early death. And this is what my father told me on the 26th of Av, 1892, in Warsaw. And that's the famous letter that everyone cites. Notice, so from the Chaim Berlin's perspective, I mean, that's without knowing what's in the Russian archives, that's what you would assume, why the yeshiva was closed, because the government did say, unless you have secular studies for 6 hours a day, it has to close. As and then it's refused that. What does it mean then that you should not put any limude chol in? There we already know that there was some limude chol, but maybe we can, in order, unless you're if unless you want to say don't want if you don't want to say that what he's saying here is false, you can say teaching Russian language is not limude chol. I think that's how you have to understand it. Some people have said that this letter is not accurate. That Reb Chaim Berlin, for polemical reasons, is saying something that is not true. I don't think so. When the Nitziv allowed secular, when he allowed, let's say, Russian, maybe a little mathematics, I believe. I mean, we're told we have a little mathematics. That's I don't know if you call that limude chol the way we're thinking. It depends what you mean limude chol. On the one hand, obviously, it's limude chol. But they were the Maskilim and others were really pushing for an entire curriculum, a little bit of Russian and a separate. And remember, it's not in the yeshiva. When you talk about lachnis letocha into the yeshiva, it wasn't in the yeshiva. There was a little building next door that for an hour, maybe every other day, a student who never studied any arithmetic or never studied any Russian, you'd send them out. That's very different than having it in the yeshiva, where in the yeshiva itself, you have, from let's say 9 to 10, everyone is taking their secular studies, and now from 10 to 12, it's Gemara. And then the Nitziv never brought secular studies into the yeshiva. What he did is he allowed, not just allowed, he required for certain students that while they are students at the yeshiva, they also study some secular subjects, but that's not in the yeshiva. So I don't believe that, even read very carefully, that there's anything inaccurate in the letter of Reb Chaim Berlin, even though it's often accused of being so. Now, if you look in Schachter's article on page 113, note 6, he cites this and he cites it from a book by Aaron Sarasky, who I believe is still alive. He's written lots of hagiographies of different great rabbis, and he has a book called Todos Achinuch HaTorani B'Tkufa Chadasha, History of Torah Study in the Modern Age. And he says that this will, which I just read you, was found in the possession of the late Rav Aryeh Levine. And then, and Schachter says he doesn't know if it was ever printed in full. Well, if you look there, and he says, by the way, he says that Sarosky notes that Rabbi Levine said that Reb Chaim Berlin gave it to him before he died, and he kept it in his possession. And then he says that according to Ben Sion Yadler, quotes the book, Reb Chaim wrote this shortly before he died, so that its contents should be known for posterity. And he notes that its authenticity was challenged after Reb Chaim's death, and that the Beit Din Tzedek of Jerusalem vouched for its legitimacy a little over 3 years later. That is actually correct. If in the volume I'm looking at has letter, well, I don't know if it was 3 years later because it doesn't have the date here of when it was stated, but you have a letter here. You have at the end of it signed by Moshe Nachum Wallenstein, C. Pesach Frank, and Chaim Mendel. These are all Dayanim in Jerusalem on the Beit Din Tzedek there, and they testify that this is his actual Ketav Yad of Rav Chaim Berlin. So, I mean, Schachter doesn't know. He says he can't tell from there whether it's been published in full, but it now isn't published in full. But the testimony of the rabbis has also been published. Page 158. The title is Not to Create New Isurim. What do you mean, New Isurim? Chumras. The rabbi in, I don't know the city, Yelisavetz, I don't know where that is, a small town somewhere. He asked the Nitziv, are you allowed to plant trees next to the synagogue? Why not? Because he thought that it says in Devarim in chapter 16 verse 21, Lo sita lacha asherah kol eitz eisel mizbeach Hashem el kecha asher tasaf. Don't plant an asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord that you shall make. So he thought, Zecher beis hamikdash, we shouldn't plant trees. You know, in Har HaBayis, by the way, you can't have any trees growing there. In whole Jerusalem, today it would be hard to imagine because without trees, it's a terrible place to live. But in Jerusalem, you're not supposed to have, at least classic old Jerusalem. What does the Nitziv say? We can't create Yisurim. You're going to make a, the rabbi wants to make a parallel to, that pasuk to every synagogue. He says, we can't create, create from our just our own mind, Yisurin Shalonin Sabbat. And if you're going to say that it's Zecher the Beis HaMikdash, just like in the Beis HaMikdash, you can't do something so too in our shuls, he says, then it's Asur Livnos Beis HaKnesses LaEtzim. So say you can't build a base, a shul out of wood because we can't use the wood either. He says there's no concept. There's no such concept of doing that. And then he says, and the man said, well, also, if you have trees, people then it'll bring bilbo hadas to you. If you have a shul and around the shuls you have nice trees, people are going to want to take walks, and during davening they're going to look at it. It'll bilbo hadas. He says, listen to what the Nesiv says. Ein zehara ela musa. He says, this is not halacha. This is musar. If you want, if you can't usher it, if you want to come up with this, fine, but don't say it's usher. And he says, not all the places are the same, and not all the inyanim are the same. So you see the Nitziv pushing back, I guess, the beginning of the chumrah craze, maybe, pushing back against, if chumrah is just created from scratch. Then, page 159. Now, this is actually, it first appears, so we spoke about this. It appears in the Nitziv. Let me pick up the Nitziv in the Meshiv Dover volume 1, number 9. And it's the title going with the Mechalei Shabbos. We study the famous Tshuva, where the Nitziv says that we join with the irreligious when we have to deal with the non-Jews. Very much against the separatism that was found in Hungary and they wanted to bring in from Galicia. However, when you deal with Jews, and it's addressed to the city they give here is, well, let me just look to see if they've changed it. In the Meshiv Dover Siman Tes, it says Charoyston. I wonder if that's Charleston. I'm not sure because they're asking, they have an organization there. Which is called Beit Grace Yakov. Beth Jacob, maybe it was. I have to look in. Gurok, actually, who we mentioned, has a book on Orthodox Jews, on Jews of Charleston. And the Orthodox community goes way back there. Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich was rabbi in. He was rabbi first, I think, in Dallas, and then Charleston, then I think in Toronto, and then in London, and then well, he wasn't a rabbi. He was head of Jews College, and then in Rosh Yeshiva Amalia Dumim. And for some reason, I don't know why this book, the Igros and the Tzeva Vlozhin, they take out the name Beth Jacob. And he goes on and he explains that it's a Toeva. He explains that there's nothing wrong with davening with people who are sinners. And we even accept karbanos from the sinners. However, those people, the idolaters, and those who violate Shabbos publicly, who we don't accept sacrifices from, tefillas el toeva. His prayers, it's a toeva, it's an abomination. I think that's how you translate toeva. I saw just the other day someone saying that we've been translating it wrong. You know, everyone says homosexual acts is toeva. Someone's saying it's not true. That's not the meaning of toeva, and goes on and on. But most translations have toeva. As an abomination. How can you join together with a Machal Shabbos? His tefillah is Toeva. He's not Yotzei with that tefillah. You're not Yotzei in a minyan with having him. Shows you how much things have changed. In our communities, no one would dream of not counting Machal Shabbos. We assume that they don't know any better. Going back to the famous responsum of the Aruch HaNer, Yaakov Ettlinger, who created this concept of, which is a reflection of the times, of a God-fearing Shabbos violator, someone who comes to Shul Shabbos morning, wants to be, you know, has have a Shabbos meal Friday night, but then goes to work. The fact that he's coming to Shul shows that he wants to be part of Judaism. There wasn't such a concept earlier on. When you rejected Shabbos, you were out of the fold. The Netziv is also, he's dealing with, Bundists and people who are rejecting Judaism, people who know better, who grew up in a religious environment. So this is his response. It's quite surprising because people would not expect it. But over Shabbos, I was reading a new book which I got. It just went on HebrewBooks.org, and whenever I see a book on HebrewBook.org, I order it. And volumes 2 and 3 were already on. Now, for the first time, volume 1 is on. It's called Eila Divrei HaBris. This is how when they printed it, looks like this: Eila Divrei HaBris, volume 1, from Rav Chaim Hirschenson. We've had, I think, 4 or 5 classes on Rav Chaim Hirschenson. He's one of my favorite independent thinkers. I think if he was around today, they would call him open Orthodox. Many of his ideas are sort of a bit out there, but really brilliant and full of insight. I have all his svarim. And so on Shabbos, I was learning through the Sefer. This is all about the different covenants made. And lo and behold, on in volume 1, on page 1, what does he do? He's speaking about the Mechale Shabbos in America, and he mentions what we just saw, the Nitziv, this tshuva, which I just read to you. And he says that even though the Nitziv says, Kitfila Sam Toeva, Lo Yada Hagolim Hanal Zatzal, this great rabbi, the Nitziv, didn't know that that you could have a situation like we have in this country, in America. Therefore, he wrote what he wrote. But he wrote it, he said, for a place full of Torah, Chachamim, and Sofrim. Lo Baretz America. Not, he wasn't referring to America. And he goes on that in America, if you would push these people away, Eif Shar Yom LaRabbanei America, L'Gareisha Kol B'Chalei Shabbos, L'Gotzar Fom L'Minyim B'Esek Knesses. He says it's impossible for the rabbis of America today to drive out of the synagogue all the Mechalei Shabbos. And not allow them to even be the heads of communities, because if you do that, the communities will be entirely destroyed. And he explains on what justification in America we're talking now. this volume, 1926. Yeah. How many people were shomer Shabbos in America? 1926 was very difficult. Rav Chaim Hirschstein even has a long response and tried to be Lama Tzvus and all the people who go to work that they don't, they're not mezidim. They do it because they feel they, even if they're wrong, they feel they'll starve to death. So they, from their standpoint, it's pikuach nefesh. And but not, it's not just him. All the rabbis in America in the early part of the 20th century had to find ways of justifying, counting people in a minyan who are, and who are B'chai Shabbos. And you had this in Germany in the 19th century with Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. But Eastern Europe had a little different perspective. So that just is was Hashgacha Pratis. Now, we're going to meet one more time. There's still a couple letters I want to do in this book. And then we're going to move on to the Nitziv, his view of conversion. If he was around today and said this, they'd throw him out. But you're going to see an unbelievably liberal view on conversion. And no one knows about this, at least very few people know about it, because in all the discussions, hardly anyone cites it. We'll see what he's. Oh, I want to get to the introduction to his work on the Shiltos, in which he has a whole theory of the oral law. And then, if we have time, oh, a tshuva from Cincinnati we'll get to. We'll see what he has to say about Rabbi Rinas's Sefer. As harsh as you can imagine, that's how he writes to Rabbi Rinas. So then you have to imagine what he thought about the Brisker Derech. We'll get to that. And if we have time, I'll conclude with, well, I'll make it conclude because we will have time. Always for the last class, if I have to go an hour and a half, if you can't stay on, you can always hear the rest. We'll go 2 hours. We'll go as long as we have to. We will get to finally what I believe to be the truth, the whole story of Reina Bassia, why I think it's a fraudulent story. So many people have written about this. It's unbelievably a woman, the wife, the first wife of the Nitziv. I will show you why I believe that Torah Tamima cannot be trusted in his recollections, and not just what I'm gonna my idea, but I'll prove it to you. I think I wrote about this, and we'll get to that. In any event, let us stop now, and let me just pick up with some of the questions. We have send a few more minutes. Malka says, why could they come up with the compromise, split the Rosh Yeshiva duties? Why could they come up with the compromise? It's the Nesiv's Yeshiva. He runs the yeshiva. He wanted to give it to his son. So it's not about a compromise. He wanted his son to have the yeshiva. So he had no reason to compromise. Okay, Baruch, I'm sorry. I will tell that again. Yes, so say yes. So CZS, you were mechavein to what I was saying, that Vidurevitz was chief rabbi of America. He hasn't really, they don't really have stuff from him in publication. There is a magazine, a Torah journal, I should say, a mitzvah, which I was able to get copies of it, and I made the copies and I gave it to HebrewBooks.org, and you can go online and you can see it now. It's great because you see what the rabbis were struggling with in the first part of the 20th century, the different shilas and things they come up with. In there's at least one, maybe two articles by Rabbi Widrowitz. You have an anonymous article by Rav Chaim Hirschenson, only later does he acknowledge he wrote it, in which he says there's about 20 things that the rabbis in America have to get to work on, because if we don't, we're going to lose the community. And he's trying to find heterim for all sorts of things, like shaving with a razor. He came up with a chiddush that you can shave with a razor, because he says the only problem was that the Bic razors, that's not what's usur, it's the razors would be like that. He deals with Mechalei Shabbos questions, he deals with electricity on Shabbos and Yom Tov. He has, I think it's 20 or 22 problems. Stay here, don't go anywhere. Twenty-two problems that, in order to make his problem was he didn't want Orthodox Jews, or I don't know what to call them, Orthodox Jews. He didn't want Jews to feel like they're sinners, because let's say if you go to shul, if you go to work on Shabbos, and then you're told you're like a terrible sinner, well then what? You don't have to do anything. So he was always trying to find heterim and trying to find kulas. Now a number of these questions appear in the Malki Bakodesh. Here I have this volume. It's all in manuscript, in which he has about 15 of these questions. It's called Halachot Olam, Sheilot Zmaniyot B'Halacha. This is in his handwriting. Problem is, it's hard to read his handwriting. But I hope one day to be able to publish this volume. It's quite a large volume, as you can see it here, and it's the only unpublished response of Rav Chaim Hirschenson that we know of. It's let's see, 29 unpublished tshuvot of Rav Chaim Hirschenson, dealing with everything from Kiddushin Al Tanai to can you eat about meat problems in America, and it goes on and on and on. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, go back to the class of Rav Chaim Hirschenson. But as I said, you can see in HebrewBooks.org, also probably in Otzer HaChma, HaMitzvah, which is really the first of the rabbinic Torah journals, I think, that lasted in America more than one issue. And you'll see something from Vidrits there. So Chaim asks, weren't some of the yeshiva students Marxists or other opponents of the Marxist government who had no other institution of power to accept them? Was this true at this time? Did it impact the closure? There were. I mean, you always had the students. In 1905 in particular, you had Marxist students. You had all sorts of problems there. But at this time, it wasn't so much Marxism as just a general sense of lack of respect for authority. And rebellion. When you say they, and I mentioned already, they had no other higher institutions. So that's one of the reasons also they would go to the yeshiva. Moshe from Lakewood, I think Rav Chaim Yaakov Kamenetsky was surprised that his students didn't read Dostoevsky. Yes, he mentions that it's Nassim Kamenetsky mentions in Making of a Gadol that he when he was surprised that not just that, but the others as well, and Karenina. Yes, it's exactly what's reported there. No, Baruch, they didn't have open Orthodox factories then, although they did refer to the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin as the Beit Charoshet HaRabbanim. CZS says Harkavy was originally from Nevada. Harkavy was a Talmud Chacham. He published Response of the Gaonim, so he knew what learning meant and what was yeshiva was. CZS says Bialik was from Hasidic background. He went to Volozhin to be able to read secular material, which he couldn't read at home. Yes, it's recorded. One place it's reported that he thought that Volozhin was the center of Haskalah, and that's why he wanted to go there. He wasn't it didn't work out exactly the way he thought it would. Tzipora tells us that Aaron Sarovsky is still alive. Thank you for that. According to Bar-Ilan, they had math, and the Siv begged the Bachurim to go to class because the authorities would call the yeshiva if the students didn't attend. Yes, and that's mentioned. You'll see that in Schachter's article. Israel says, from the Netziver of Chaim's perspective, it was closed due to government decisions in secular studies and yeshiva, even though it would have been shut down anyway by the Tsarist government, which is something they had. No way of knowing. Exactly, Israel. That's what I said. Thank you. For 11 years in Charleston, there's a picture of him in Gurok's book without a beard. I always like seeing these big rabbis in their younger years before they have a beard. Harold says it's probably Charleston. Thank you. Gil Pearl noticed this as well. So Charleston, you're saying that a Charlestown. Why? Well, Charleston is Charlestown. Harold, do you mean Charleston, South Carolina, which had a nice Jewish community? And then it was asked questions from America, all over America. Well, next week, we'll see the question he was asked from Cincinnati. So I don't know of any other Charlestown that has a Jewish community other than Charleston. Moshe says he also had harsh words for Yosef Chaya Stern's approach. Yeah, maybe we'll get to that. But yes, Jay, Baruch, recordings are available of this session. If you came in late, you can get them. Recordings are around for everything. A couple more minutes. Let me just see the last things here. According to Rav Chaim Malk says, according to Rav Charlap, first was mocked the safety razor, and this psak was followed by the clean-shaven Lithuanian yeshiva students. With all due respect to Rav Charlap, I can't say if that's true. I've never heard that. He did matter it, and Rabbi Rabinovich, actually, he has a volume on Army Halacha, Mumde Muhammad, I think, which he mentions this and he discusses it. And Rav Charlap, I have to say, is actually knows a lot about the American rabbinic world. So he, if he has it by tradition that some people follow this psak, then I guess, as they say, if it's tradition, we'll accept it. But if you read the literature, no one accepted this. This was regarded as way overboard. Rav Chaim Hirschhausen was never accepted in the Lithuanian yeshiva world to begin with because too many of his ideas were considered too liberal. So why the Lithuanian yeshivas, and you're assuming, I assume you're talking about Lithuanian yeshiva students in America. I can never imagine a Lithuanian yeshiva student in Europe relying on this. They use the depilatory. But okay, if someone can ask Rav Charlap, I was quite surprised that Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich knew this responsum of Rav Chaim Hirschhausen, but he deals with it. Okay, Eliyahu asks, how do I read the response of Meshiv Davar on working with the non-observant? Isn't he simply saying the situation is different in Russia from Western Europe because the factions are different and not that he supported with working non-observant Jews? Perhaps we dealt with this. Yeah, we dealt with this two classes ago. I think it's clear that he's talking about, it's not about the situation, the countries per se, it's the direction of the who you're dealing with. That he talks about dealing that there is outside, you're dealing with in terms of, let's say, the outsiders. When we deal with outsiders, we're deal, maybe this is what you meant, but in Russia, it's a problem because the community has a, I guess you would say, enemies, as it were, on the outside, and we need to be unified in that respect versus internally. At least that's how I read it. It's true when you read the responsum as a whole, he's talking about, the battle with the Tzedukim, and that we can't call each other heretics, etc. But I also said that, the ones he's referring to are, he's referring to, he's not referring to complete heretics, number one. And number two, the whole context there is that, if the community will break down, if, because like this, you have like just like the Romans on the outside, so too, I guess the Russian government. But if you just were to take the tshuva, that's number 144, Al Yaminu Smol, and without knowing who he's speaking about, the context, I think you could see it as a contradiction, perhaps. But I don't know, because like he, maybe not. He speaks about the needs of Lachazek as adat b'kirbeinu, and we have to. I don't know. We have to look more carefully at that. My reading of it, which I explained last week, was that. It's not just internally here. The issue there is focusing on that we have to be focused also on how we appear as a community. We don't want to destroy the entire community. As we fight among ourselves, that's okay, but we're still one community. But if the fighting leads to the complete destruction of the community, and therefore we're no longer one community, then that's what he sees as problematic, and that's what Rav Kook. That's how Rav Kook understood it, and Rav Soloveitchik. And Rav Soloveitchik speaks about how when we deal with the non-Jews, we all have to deal as one community, and we fight among ourselves. He, at least I assume, he's reflecting the tradition he knows from his own family, that that's how you relate to the non-Jews. You relate as one community. As we know, in Vilna, in Poland, every community was unified. You had Bundists, you had Zionists, you had Orthodox all together. Unlike in other places. Of course, they fought with each other, but they remained one community. So that's how I would distinguish it between the sort of fights. I think this is the best way to put it, the sort of fights that will destroy the community, so you no longer have one Jewish community, versus internal fights that we fight about people we disagree with. If you disagree, if you have a different way of reading it, please email me and we can come back to it in the last class last week. Did any notable, famous, or infamous rabbis come from the government yeshivas? You had all sorts of people who came from them. You just mentioned Harkavy, but no one who became known, as far as I know, maybe Eliyahu knows better, of great or Moshe, great rabbis, anyone who was respected in the Torah world. You did have teachers in those institutions occasionally who were respected. Katzenelnbogen. I mostly remember his name. I forget the published. I forget the book he published. Taught at the and then Vilna was better than Zhytomyr. The story with the Chafetz Chaim abolishing the decree, I don't know if it's false. Maybe it's true. Where he went to the Polish minister. Of course, it fits very well with the hagiography that no one else can pass can get this law changed, and the great rabbi with the beard who doesn't speak any Polish and all he has is tears, and that causes a change. Is that what caused it? I don't know. I mean, it has all the has all the appurtenances of a hagiographic story. What's more interesting is that when the Chafetz Chaim wanted to come to the rabbinic meeting, Rav Meir Simcha said, "You're not a rabbi," because he wasn't a rabbi of the community, and he said, "We don't want you here." And that's it shows you that the other rabbis were much more liberal in this matter than the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim, who was not a community rabbi, maybe could be more extreme in that matter in that way. I mean, the story is interesting with Chafetz Chaim. When they were going to go meet the Polish minister, they wanted to send one of the rabbis who knew Polish. After all, you're going to speak to the Polish minister, you have to speak Polish. And there were plenty of rabbis who spoke Polish. You even had one in the parliament, the Reicher Rav, Nat Lewin's great grandfather. Rav Aaron Lewin was a member of the Polish parliament. And the Chafetz Chaim, with a lot of insight, said, no, we can't have any of the Polish rabbis, any of the rabbis who speak Polish, go speak to the minister, because then he's going to look at them and say, hey, this is a rabbi with a long beard and he speaks Polish. So how can you tell me that you can't have Polish in the yeshivas? He says, we can only go with those who don't speak Polish. No, Moshe from Lakewood, when he says not to work with the non-observant, does that include for yeshivas? No, he never says not to work with the non-observant. He says not to daven with the non-observant. However, for matters of communal concern, you do work with the non-observant. And we already saw a couple of classes ago, he justifies and explains dafka why we have to work with the non-observant. And he attacks those who say that when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, we should not work with the non-observant. He believes in working with the non-observant for matters of communal concern. And the most important matter of communal concern was, well, one of the most was for Eretz Yisrael, as well as government decrees, etc. So he's not a separatist in the sense of a Hirschian separatist. He's very much against it. The people he's responding to, the Machzik Yadas and the Tshuva, volume 1, number 44, they wanted to create Hungarian separatism in Galicia, and he's right, and then presumably that would then he'd want to spread it to Russia, and he's writing against it. Benny Brown has a whole article on this. What was it that the Russian rabbis and the Polish rabbis, why were they so opposed to the separatism that took off in Hungary and in Germany? And I think the answer, of course, is the different type, they're dealing with different types of Jews. They're not dealing with reformers. I don't know, CZS, is it Charleston, West Virginia? Was there a Kehillah there? I don't know. Okay. Baruch, not relevant to the class. Do I have Jewish students at the University of Scranton? I sometimes have Jewish students, but almost always they don't realize they're Jewish. The maternal grandmother is Jewish. Okay, my Sephardic matzahs. I have to tell you, with all the money we're all losing, Shlomo, I don't think I'm going into Brooklyn this year to get my Sephardic matzahs. They're not, they're soft matzahs. They're not Sephardic matzahs, actually. If you look back the way all Jews had soft matzahs, look how they described the matzahs from 200 years ago, how thick they were. We all had this soft matzah. And they weren't square. Even when they got thin, they were round. Sarna has a nice article on that. Okay, let me just finish up one or two more. Okay, so why don't we just end with this? Eli Rubinstein, Rav Nachman Rabinovich, who I've said many times, is, I believe, the leading halachic authority today in the religious Zionist world. He's really the elder of Rosh Yeshiva. I mean, some people are not crazy about his right-wing views politically, but he has enormous insight, a great scholar. New volume of Yad Peshuta just came out on the Rambam. His responses were published in recent years. He's also involved in the Beit Din in Israel with Rabbi Amsalam, with a more liberal approach to conversions, and they're converting children. So there's a lot to say about him. And Alan Nadler wrote what is it, Jewish Review Books? I forget where he wrote it. He wrote a memoir of sorts of his Rebbe, Nachum Rabinovich, because that Nadler studied for a time in Jews College when Rabinovich was there. I heard from Jonathan Sachs. I've only spoken to him a few times, but he said once that he regards Rav Nachum Rabinovich, and this was, he told me this is like 15 years ago, Rav Nachum Rabinovich as the greatest rabbi that we have. Great. So, and that's who he regards as his Rebbe. Of course, when he was chief rabbi of England, he was forced to adopt certain positions not in line with his Rebbe. His Rebbe, Rabinovich, accepted brain death, but the Beis Din of London didn't. Nachum Rabinovich also says you can go on the Temple Mount. Okay, final comment here, and he's a Talmud, yes, of Rav Hirschsprung, PhD in mathematics. Rav Nachum Rabinovich came to Toronto from Charleston. So your family had the honor of hosting him. very good. Well, thank you all for we had a big group tonight. I know we're all home. Let's hopefully we're all staying safe. We'll meet one more time and we'll finish up with the Nitziv. We still have some interesting things. Those of you who have interest in the Nitziv, the other classes are online. You can obviously download them. And if anyone wants to call my attention to things that I didn't say or I should have said, email it to me and we'll start with it next time. And I'll take another look at, I'll read through again the Tshuva, Volume 1, Number 44, to see if I have to add anything to what I've already said. As I mentioned, for those who weren't in last week, there's a whole English translation. Howard Joseph has an English translation of the entire Responsum, Volume 1, Number 44, and a discussion of it, where and he titles it with the classic words of the Nitziv, that separatism, separating from our fellow Jews, is like daggers in our heart. That's, we do not separate. We fight among ourselves, but we remain one community. We don't separate. And as I said, and I'll end with this, Rav Kook says on his deathbed, Rav Kook said, do not create separate communities. And it isn't something original to Rav Kook. He's just following the tradition given to him by his Rebbe, the Nitziv. So good night, everyone.